Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today we check in with leaders of the soybean and pork farmers of Siouxland and find out how they're faring with this year's harvest in light of retaliatory tariffs from China. But first, we have an update on efforts to keep doors open at the University of Iowa's Labor Center. The Labor Center conducts educational programming for workers and organizations across the state. Following mid-year budget cuts in fiscal 2018, the State Board of Regents approved closing the University of Iowa Labor Center, and Iowans from across the state gathered Monday to protest the decision and take up efforts to keep the center open directly to UI President Bruce Harold. Jennifer Shearer is the director of the Labor Center. Shearer says supporters are making good progress in trying to keep the center open.
You know, people have continued to voice their concerns really since July. July is when they made this announcement unexpectedly. And I think it was probably in September, there was a coalition that did a series of public hearings around the state, and including Sioux City, which probably was in September, I think. And that input was fed back to the Board of Regents and to university administrators, and students and faculty on campus have been very active in calling on university administration to restore funding. And so we're at a point where we're really having much more productive discussions about the center's future. And we're not quite there yet with a final resolution, but a lot of people have come forward to put a lot of the pieces in place to try to make that happen.
Could you talk a little bit about what the Labor Center does and why it's been so important to so many people?
Yeah, we have a statewide mission. We're the only unit in the whole public university region system in Iowa that's devoted to worker research and education. And so we work with students and faculty on campus, but we also work with workers all over the state, doing education on workplace rights, including, how to combat discrimination and harassment, worker health and safety. I mean, when this announcement was made, we had people calling the first couple days saying, you can't close this unit down. This is a program that saves people's lives, right? That people really value the education they get from this program, which has been here since 1951. Because they've seen how it can give them tools in their own workplaces and tools in their own communities to make improvements, and really has a direct impact on the state as a whole, and safer, fairer, more equitable workplaces. And, I think many people have just come forward and said, that's been good for me personally, but it's been good for multiple generations of Iowa workers and employers and the state as a whole.
Do you think that a lot of people had heard of it, but maybe they didn't really know some of them, all the things that the center has done and continues to do?
Yeah, I think that's true. We in an average year, the center reaches 2,000 to 2,500 workers directly. So there's a large number of people who interface with us very directly or have come to campus for one of our programs. But I think people who hadn't maybe been directly involved in the center have learned a lot through this process from the people who have experienced the educational resources. And of course, people often have said they took tools and knowledge back to their workplace and shared it with other people, right? So even people who maybe weren't directly in a class indirectly got the benefits of that.
And I believe when the issue with the Labor Center came up, it was one of several centers that basically officials were looking at saying, can we cut funding to some of these? Do we need all of these? I wonder if it would have gone, unsung if people had not sort of come out and shown their support for it.
Oh, yeah, I think that's definitely true, that the public response and Iowans coming forward and saying this is really something we value, and in a moment we might be dealing with tight budgets, it doesn't mean that we should make hasty decisions or permanently damage or destroy something that's been a very important institution for almost 70 years. And in fact, we have to make really careful decisions in those kinds of circumstances about what the best choices are and what our budget priorities are.
You said you think you're making progress on this. Would you say that you're doing better in terms of support and likelihood of, you know, continuing in your mission?
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of the public support, it just hasn't waned at all. And I would say it's even growing, you know, so that has been really heartening. And in terms of the discussions with administrators, I would just say that the progress is that the most recent discussions we had were at the point where finally we're really having really concrete discussions about budget numbers, which is heartening. And I think there's a number of people in those discussions who, along with us, can put a lot of pieces together and hopefully come to a resolution and a solution soon. Like I said, we're not quite there yet. There's a clear recognition, I think, at this point that the Labor Center's future does have to include some financial commitment, some budgetary commitment from the university and the College of Law where our unit is housed. And so the question is just, you know, will it be enough? And that's kind of where things stand.
It has been tough over the last few years with so many departments and whole programs and centers like the Labor Center being cut. Sometimes people might think there's not a lot that they can do, but I think maybe in your case, it's shown that maybe people can end up actually exercising more power than they think they might have had.
I think that's true. And I think that people have really, in some cases, welcomed the opportunity to step forward and say public education, public higher education, units with a statewide mission that serve the state are important to us. And, you know, it's not that the state as a whole or our economy as a whole doesn't have enough resources to support these things. It really is a question of how are we choosing to use the resources? How are we distributing the resources? And so that really has been fundamental to a lot of this public discussion.
Do you know when you'll find out the, you know, ultimately what's going to happen with the center? Do you have any idea?
Well, all I can say is that we're trying to continue and move those discussions along as fast as we can. And we hope to have at least another couple discussions yet this month. And the university's really had a whole semester at this point, right, to hear from people, to learn, to digest all the information. And, you know, everybody's ready for let's get a solution in place.
That was Jennifer Shearer, the director of the University of Iowa Labor Center. Shearer says a large crowd of supporters gathered on Monday in the state Senate room in the old state Capitol building on the campus to show their support for keeping the threatened Labor Center open. Since the founding of the Labor Center in 1951, tens of thousands of Iowa workers and union members have benefited from courses and workshops that were headed up by the Labor Center. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Earlier this year, President Donald Trump instituted higher tariffs on steel and other goods from China, and the Chinese responded in kind with tariffs on pork, corn, and soybeans. For soybean farmers, the loss of the Chinese market has been worrying in a year of a better-than-average harvest. Many farmers have decided to store their soybeans until better prices and better markets come along. Lindsay Greiner is the president of the Iowa Soybean Growers Association. Greiner recently returned from Barcelona, where he and nearly 300 soybean farmers and industry stakeholders attended a four-day event hosted by the U.S. Soybean Export Council. To mitigate soybean export losses to China, Greiner and other farmers are talking with soy importers and end users about the value and quality of this year's record U.S. crop. Greiner says initial feedback during industry visits about the future demand for U.S. soy is promising. However, price is still the key factor.
It was called Europe and Middle East and Northern Africa Buyers Conference. So it was a lot of buyers, you know, feed mills, crushers, and then there were some farmers represented from the United States and some industry experts to give presentations. But primarily, targeted towards buyers, soybean buyers.
What kind of issues did you discuss? Did the issue of tariffs come up?
Well, you know, the last few months, the issue of tariffs always comes up. So you know, yeah, we talked about that. But what's happened in that region is the tariffs have really increased the amount of soybeans that are being purchased from Europe and Middle East and Northern Africa. So they, you know, we talked about it a lot, but the main focus was, you know, how do you like our soybeans? What can we do to create some kind of a loyalty or a preference for our soybeans? And are you having any issues? Kind of a relationship building type of thing, and an appreciation for their purchases of our beans.
Lately, the farmers I've talked to say how upset they are and concerned about these tariffs and China, and they're concerned about not being able to sell their soybeans so they can make a profit. They were talking about the government checks they've been getting, but that, you know, is barely enough to cover what they've put in.
Well, when you lose a market like China, I mean, they were just so big that it's going to impact the market. Now, you take like Europe and the region I talked about, Europe, Middle East, and Northern Africa, they're buying a lot of beans from us. They're buying a lot of beans basically because there aren't any in South America to buy because they're all going to China. But nevertheless, they're buying a lot of beans from us. But if they buy all the beans that they need from us, it still can't make up for what we lost in China. So it's good, but it's not as good as it would be as if we had China back. And then you couple that with the fact that we're coming off of a record large soybean crop. So we've got more than one factor working against us as far as the markets go. We've got large supplies and a loss of our largest customer.
So what are farmers doing this fall? They're storing up their soybeans?
I think there's a lot of soybeans going into storage. You know, some farmers have beans forward contracted for a really good price. You know, if you got them sold before probably the 1st of June, you probably got some pretty decent prices for some of these forward contracted beans. And I'd say the rest of them went in storage. The market facilitation program, that 82.5 cents we got, I mean, that's a little bit of a Band-Aid. None of the farmers I talked to were all that enthused about it. They'd rather have the China market back and let the market really do its work. But some of those things help, but I think by and large, a lot of the beans went into the bin and farmers are going to wait for better prices.
Have you heard anything from lawmakers, from the federal government about the possibility of this tariff situation being cleared up?
Well, not really. I mean, the news I've heard about the tariff situation being cleared up came out of Argentina on Saturday night when President Trump and President Xi sat down and agreed in principle to start negotiating, and China agreed to start purchasing more ag products. And I think there's a little cautiousness right now as to whether they really will follow through with that. So I think there's some optimism, but it's cautious optimism right now.
Is this going to put some soybean farmers, maybe not out of business, but end up having them, you know, planning to, you know, plant a lot fewer soybeans next year, looking to other crops, that kind of thing?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt we're going to see a reduction in soybean acres next year. Now, it's up for debate how many acres are going to be shifted. But when you look at prices, you know, well, if you're at $9 on the board, well, there's a lot of basis issues right now, especially in the Dakotas. So if you're looking as a farmer and your local price is going to be in that $8.25 to $8.50 range and your cost of production is probably at $9.25 to $9.50, you're probably not going to be too enthused about growing a crop that you're going to lose a dollar a bushel on. So you take some areas like the Dakotas and maybe even some areas like Arkansas and Alabama and Louisiana, there's probably going to be some acreage shift to some other crops that at least you can break even on there, because nothing right now is all that great as far as commodities. But we're going to see acreage shifts, and we're going to see some financial stress on the part of farmers. So it's going to be a tough tough time.
A lot of farmers around here supported President Trump in the last election or the 16 election. What do you hear from them politically? Are they thinking about changing how they vote? Has it gone that far?
Well, I don't think so, but you know, that's basically my opinion. With the things that I hear from farmers are, and especially early on when the trade war was still just developing, you know, we're in favor of it. He ran on this issue. He said he was going to do it. So it's really not a surprise that he's following through with it. And so we're behind it. We really do need better deals. We realize there are things that China has taken advantage of us over the years as far as trade. But I think as time went on, patience was starting to wear out. The farmer said, well, you know, yeah, we're behind it, but let's get something done. Let's sit down and negotiate. Let's get a deal worked out. So I think that was the good news that came out of this meeting in Argentina on Saturday night. Maybe the ball is starting to roll on negotiations, and there's better times ahead. So I think the farmers are still kind of behind it, but farmers are not usually the most patient bunch, and I think they want something to get done. I think it's important to realize that, you know, this is farming. It's business of ups and downs, and sometimes things go really good, and sometimes they don't go good. But I really hope and I really believe that China and the United States are going to sit down here and in the next 90 days get some kind of a deal worked out. And if that happens, it's probably going to be pretty good for agriculture.
That was Lindsay Greiner, the president of the Iowa Soybean Growers Association. Greiner returned from a trade mission to Barcelona recently. The U.S. has overtaken Brazil as the top soybean supplier to many European countries, as well as the Middle East and Northern Africa, in the wake of retaliatory tariffs on soybeans from America on the part of China. Pork farmers have also been affected by those retaliatory tariffs. However, their outlook may be a bit better than that of soybean farmers. Al Yonke is the executive director of the Nebraska Pork Producers in Lincoln. Yonke says pork producers have been receiving their subsidies from the federal government, and a bit more may be on the way.
You know, the market facilitation program sign-up started on September 4th. And people have to go into their USDA FSA office to get that paperwork done and get it handed in. And I know that the pork producers I've heard from here in Nebraska, at least, have really told me it's been a smooth process. They've been able to get in there, received all the help they needed from the FSA staff, and really reported receiving their checks in a remarkably short period of time for the federal government. You know, a lot of times we expect government checks to have to break through the red tape and take a while to get in the mail. But my folks that I'm hearing from are reporting that things are going pretty smooth right now. So that's good. And kudos to the USDA for processing those payments as rapidly as they are.
You mentioned something I hadn't really thought about, that there'll be more checks, and these will be from the government's purchase of pork products.
Right. Well, there's two other opportunities. Now, the first market facilitation program sign-up started on the 4th, and basically pork producers can get up to $8 per pig that they had in inventory as of August 1st of 2018. But they're only paying half of that in the first check. Now, in December, they're going to make the decision, Secretary Perdue and the USDA, whether to do the other half, the other $4. Indications are now that they probably will be doing that because our prices haven't improved that much that I think they would cancel it. So you don't have to reapply again, but you do have an opportunity to get another check just for your single application. And I should note, too, while we're on this, that you have until January 15th to make those applications. So there's still plenty of time, and we continue to remind people over the next couple months here, January 15th is the deadline. So if you haven't gotten in there, whether it's for your pigs or your corn or your soybeans, you have until that date to get in. Now, the second thing is there is another bigger piece to that market facilitation program, and that's a pork purchase plan by the USDA and the federal government. They're going to go out in the market and actually purchase pork products from our processors and packers here in the United States. And that purchase is roughly $550 million. Now, to put that in perspective, the largest single purchase of pork, I believe, that they have ever made in the past was around $54 million. So we're talking about a tenfold increase in what had been the largest purchase they've ever done on pork products. Now, that purchase will take place over the upcoming months or year, and be distributed to food banks and schools and other entities that receive these public assistance, food dollars, and offerings. And again, that's a big enough purchase. We're hopeful that that may even somewhat affect market prices and tick them up a little bit by buying that much product at a time in the market.
I've heard before about this African swine fever. How do you think, right, if this becomes an issue, could it possibly help pork farmers? Because it'll make the Chinese might have to buy from us after all? Or?
Right. Yeah, as you know, we're still dealing with tariffs, both with Mexico in retaliation for the aluminum and steel tariffs that were put on them. And we also have tariffs from China right now in a back and forth kind of trade war that's happening. And that has affected certainly our sales to China. China is number one, the biggest consumer of pork in the world, but number two, they're the biggest producer of pork in the world, but they cannot produce enough pork to feed their population over there. So unfortunately for China, African swine fever is being reported all over the country, all over the pork producing areas in China right now. I believe they have just had to dispose of nearly a million pigs over there due to the disease. So that's certainly worrisome, I know, for the Chinese. But when you look at us as suppliers of product to world markets like China, there may be some future opportunities as their supply perhaps is damaged locally by African swine fever, gives us an opportunity with or without tariffs to perhaps get some product of ours moving back into the countryside. Should that happen, again, hopefully that means our prices go up, and hopefully it means that our soybean partner prices go up who are feeding our pigs, because now we're gonna grow more pigs for that market, and it's just kind of a domino effect. But long story short, I know that our leadership here in the country is meeting with Chinese leadership even this week. We hope there is tariff talks, and we hope, even though it's a bad thing to have African swine fever, maybe that is an impetus to start some of those talks in earnest on both sides again and see how we handle the situation.
It seems like pork producers are doing a little better, or they seem a little less worried than soybean producers. I don't know if I have that wrong. I've heard from some soybean producers who are pretty concerned about the tariffs and not making enough money this year.
Right. Yeah, and we're concerned about all of agriculture. I mean, from a pork standpoint, our prices were depressed this year, especially prior to solving the NAFTA deal. Now that we are signing agreements with Canada and Mexico on the U.S. Mexico-Canada agreement that's just put forth, we've seen our markets perhaps strengthen a little bit going out into the future. But from summer to fall, our markets were at probably some of the lowest points we've seen historically in quite some time. So that's why the $8 was offered, to make up for some of those losses. We were having losses at that time. But overall, yeah, the pork industry has been able to fairly hold their own, and we hope to do that going forward too. But our message has always been, we're free traders. You know, we don't want tariffs. We want a market, and we have great producers that grow a great sustainable product that actually tastes good. So let us grow it and let us sell it across the world. And please get out of the way with tariffs has always been our message.
Is there anything else you think is important or you'd like people to know? What do you think will happen with the African swine fever going forward?
One message I always leave people with when we're talking about that And knock on wood, it is not in the United States. It's not in Mexico. It's not in Canada. So it has nothing to do with affecting our herds and our animals at this point in time. So number one, we have redoubled our efforts to monitor and screen not only products, food products and feed products going back and forth internationally, but also talking to people who travel internationally who might have opportunities to be in processing plants or on farms, to let them know when they come back that there needs to be waiting periods, and we need to be very we need to recognize what's going on and make sure we're not moving that disease around. But number two, no matter where the disease is in the world, and it's in a number of countries right now, and we always plan for things like that in the United States and hope they don't happen, African swine fever only affects the pigs. It has no effect whatsoever on humans. And I think that's an important message to get out there, because there is African swine fever, and people always wonder, well, should we quit eating pork, or is there something wrong with my hot dogs or my ham? And the answer is no. It does not affect human health in any way. So we want to keep that message alive and well as this disease works its way around the world.
Do our pigs always die from this?
Pretty much. I mean, that's the sad part is there's no vaccines for it at this point in time. And the only treatment measures are to cull the herd and dispose of those bodies. So, clean the barns and get going again. So yes, it was, you know, like avian influenza a few years ago, the way that we did it was to depopulate those birds. And unfortunately that's what happens with this disease, which is why, you know, number one, we're doing a lot more research on it, trying to figure out if there is something we could do beyond depopulation. But then certainly number two, redoubling our efforts to prevent it so we never have to go through that type of thing. Because as you know, farmers raise animals and their job is to keep those animals alive and healthy. And whether it's foot and mouth disease or whether it's African swine fever or whether it's any of the other numerous animal infectious diseases out there, putting an animal down is not what a farmer wants to do, and it's not a happy day when that happens. So we're vigilant. Again, we're doing everything we can to keep our herds healthy and continue down the path of good, sustainable production that we do here in the United States.
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about the growth of hog production in Northeast Nebraska, just across the bridge here.
Yeah, and you're right. Northeast Nebraska is actually growing pretty rapidly in pork production right now. And, of course, we just had the Hormel plant sale there in Fremont. That was over 200 farmers that bought that plant. So you can expect a lot more barns going up in that vicinity, up in the Northeast area, from these farmers that purchased the plant. So we're excited about the growth opportunities here in Nebraska, too, right now going on. It's part of the Pipestone Systems up in Pipestone, Minnesota, is a kind of a farmer co-op group. And a lot of those farmers got together as a buying group and bought out the Hormel plant in Fremont. So that plant is now going to be farmer owned. They're still going to do the Hormel products in there, the Spam and the Little Sizzlers and everything. So they have a contract with Hormel, but they are moving their headquarters there. They're expanding that plant and putting in new equipment over the next 3 to 5 years. And so not only a lot of jobs, a lot of new probably pig farms coming that way to help out with that plant, and a lot of opportunities up in the Fremont and the Northeast area up there. So it's exciting. Pig production continues to grow, and the new model now is kind of farmer ownership of the packing plants, which is something we've seen over the last few years.
That was the executive director of the Nebraska Pork Producers Association, Al Yunke. Yunke talked about subsidies pork producers have been receiving to take the edge off retaliatory tariffs by China. And he also discussed the possible economic effects of swine fever in that country, as well as the growth of farmer-owned pork plants in Northeast Nebraska. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. After 2 years of releasing seesaw estimates, Iowa Medicaid leaders have been calculating how much the state is saving by hiring private companies to manage its $5 billion Medicaid program. Last week, State Auditor Mary Mosman said the May 2018 estimate of $141 million in annual savings was more accurate than earlier state estimates of $234 million and $47 million, respectively. Mosman's office estimates the fiscal year 2018 savings at $126 million. The auditor criticized the Iowa Department of Human Services for failing to have an accurate way to estimate the savings when the state made the shift to private Medicaid management back in 2016. Democrats have heavily criticized the move to privately managed Medicaid, and they weren't swayed by the audit's findings. Sioux City Democratic State Representative Chris Hall has long been concerned about the effect of privatized Medicaid financially and in the terms of its effects on patients, who Hall says may not be receiving the level of care they need and deserve.
If you look at the audit and the fact that it's now released after an election, when this was a front and center issue throughout most of the campaign, the release of the audit seems to be a little bit convenient to begin with. The numbers that Department of Human Services has said are being saved by privatized Medicaid have bounced all over the board. What her report did show is that it is saving half of what Governor Branstad originally promised would be saved. So it's not living up to its original promise. It's still costing the state a lot of money. And the audit also doesn't go into how is the quality of care? Are these providers actually paying receipts on time? Are they providing reasonable health care to Iowans? And if there's no question of the quality of care or whether the functional payment of providers out there is happening, all it's really saying is here's a number we finally can agree on, and it's still saving some money, but not for a better system by any means.
Now, this was a Democrat, Pam Yoakum of Dubuque, who first suggested this audit, but it doesn't sound like she's satisfied with the results she's gotten.
An audit has the potential to uncover a lot of different things. Some of it can be cost accounting. Some of it can also be delivery of services or improvements that can be made. The state auditor's office is really geared at trying to assure taxpayers that there is an efficient use of their dollars and a worthwhile use of their dollars. And that cannot yet be said for privatized Medicaid. Stories across the state have been highlighted at length talking about the difficulty healthcare providers have in being reimbursed for their care, and also that normal health consumers have in receiving decent care. And so the system doesn't seem to be functioning at a very surface level, and this audit didn't provide any additional information or, I don't think, give people a lot of confidence in the system itself.
And the question a lot of people seem to have, and not just Democrats, is, you know, is the state really saving as much as it had hoped when it embarked on this privatization venture? I know a lot of other states are also going to Medicaid privatization.
Well, there are a lot of different issues that exist within it. First of all, the rate of savings is significantly less than was originally promised. Second, the cost of health care and the cost of privatized Medicaid is still increasing at a rate faster than in most other states. And last, I think you can point to the quality of care issues and the fact that the system, after being completely overhauled, is just not functioning. It's not doing what it's intended to do. It's giving insurance companies and out-of-state companies this huge profit incentive and a much, much higher overhead cost than it was when the state was managing the system. None of those things have changed. It still needs vast improvements, and there's a lot of question of whether taxpayer dollars are being well spent.
It also sounds like vendors aren't getting paid on time, and that has been a big issue.
There's another Medicaid provider, one of these managed care organizations, that has now left the state and has been gone for more than a year, and they have tens of millions of dollars in unpaid bills. So there are providers out there, whether it's a hospital or a retirement facility, there are providers out there who have been waiting for bills and reimbursement for over a year, and this company's just left the state. There are a lot of big issues and millions of dollars that aren't going into our local economy or helping these small businesses to just make sure that their ends meet and their normal book of business is balanced.
There have been a lot of stories in the press all across the state about people who are disabled or older and in need of services. And because of the way the system has been changing, some of them have not been able to stay in their homes. They've had to move into assisted living, whereas before they were able to afford to have caregivers come to their home.
Yes, the incentives within the system right now seem a little bit backwards. It incentivizes putting people in a care facility, which costs much more than trying to help somebody stay in their own home or have a family member or part-time provider help take care of them. And it also, just the quality of care has plummeted. People are having a hard time, whether they're elderly or disabled or whoever they are, they're just having a very difficult time getting approval for normal things like medication for diabetes or an oxygen tank, something that actually very literally helps them to breathe. They can't actually get approval for very basic services. And if you need oxygen and you're not being approved for it, that's a pretty big problem.
Several Democrats have said they would like to change the system back to the public state-run Medicaid system. It doesn't seem like that's likely to happen with a Republican governor and Republicans controlling the House and the Senate. What kinds of things do you think could happen that could help make this system work better?
We will need to. It is unfortunate that we haven't been able to get these things resolved to this point. Democrats generally have been thoughtful. We've provided some alternative ideas. We've provided amendments throughout last year's debate and budget that would have improved the system and guaranteed better payment and better quality of health care. Those ideas largely have not been adopted, and so we still have to hold out hope that somewhere along the line there can be bipartisan input and some true decision points that say, we need to change, we need to improve privatized Medicaid. It's not working in the state, and it's, I think, apparent to most citizens. We'll do our best to continue offering constructive ideas. I hope that the Republican legislature and Governor Reynolds finally come around to it and have their eyes opened after what was, I would say, the top issue discussed this last campaign cycle. The rest of the state is waiting for them to catch up.
Looking ahead to the next legislative session in January, there are a lot of issues surrounding taxes and tax credits. Even some Republicans now are questioning the large amount of money given in tax credits to outside companies that come in and, whether or not that's been a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's just a basic analysis of our state budget and how it's grown or how it's shrunk in certain areas. There are fewer dollars going to higher education than there were just a few years ago, and there are more dollars going to out-of-state companies and big corporations. And, in certain cases, that might work. You might have a year or two where your cost of tax credits or business incentives balloon. But to have it without a cap on those costs, without some reasonable requirements that they stay within a certain amount of dollars, they just have continued to grow exponentially. And every dollar that has been available now as a business incentive is a dollar that isn't going into basic services like healthcare or education. There's a finite number of dollars and a lot of good things that compete for them. But if more and more of them go to these uncapped programs or business incentives, and sometimes at a very high cost for a few number of jobs, taxpayers deserve and citizens deserve for us to apply some scrutiny to them. And they also deserve to have us apply very reasonable common sense things like a cap on the program. If they've run away as a cost to the state, one would think that people of good faith can come together and apply just some basic sense to it.
Do you think that IPERS will be challenged this year? Some people are concerned, as they have been in past years, that IPERS might become a different kind of benefit system that would offer less to the people who are investing in it.
I've heard from countless IPERS recipients, a lot of retired educators, a lot of road workers. You know, IPERS is a system that touches hundreds of thousands of people in the state and really also has a lot to do with putting dollars into Iowa's rural economy. There are many people who are concerned about changes that would be made to the system. And I think the reason for that concern stems from 2 years ago when the Republicans took control of the legislature. They did not campaign on gutting the collective bargaining system for public employees, but that was item and agenda number one when they started session. It was not something that was really a highlight issue until they completely overhauled and wrecked the system. And so, you know, for the same, a lot of the same individuals to be told repeatedly, your IPERS is safe so long as you're in the system, and you can tell that Governor Reynolds and others hedge on the question. Clearly, they don't want to answer, what about future recipients? What about people who are new to the IPERS system? Are you willing to make changes there? And when they don't give a forthright answer, it leaves a lot of suspicion and I think reasonable concern from people who depend on the system for their retirement. They want a forthright answer and they want to be told that their retirement security is safe.
It seems like every year lately, the IPERS system is discussed, the future of the IPERS system, and people are concerned that it might be changed from the way it works now to make it a different kind of benefit package.
You know, last I think I checked, the IPERS system was 82 or 83% solvent, which compared to other public retirement systems is very good. And it has grown with solvency, with the stock market recovering, and also because of some very deliberate changes that the legislature made in 2010 to make it a stronger system. And so we should continue to try and improve its solvency, make sure that the system is continually solvent into the future. You know, stealing money from the IPERS system or robbing it for other causes, I think would receive a quick and pretty strong backlash from people across the state. I don't think it's really a Democrat or Republican issue if your retirement depends on it.
A lot of that IPERS money goes right back into our local cities and towns and counties because that's where most of our retirees live. So it seems like it's pretty vital to the health of our communities.
And, you know, out in a lot of rural communities, if you think about the state of Iowa and 99 counties, that means that we have 99 courthouses, that we have law enforcement and DOT and road personnel. And, you know, the lifeblood of many rural communities is their courthouse, their school district, and their hospital. And in some form or another, government helps to support those rural communities and keep those doors open. We're not going to ever become a state where we don't have children to educate and people to take care of. And so it's important that we also value the people who go into public service and value the people who live in this state and hope to have a secure retirement so that they can provide for their families. Respecting workers and people who go into public service is something that all people should care about.
You didn't have an opponent this year, but you were out campaigning and talking to your constituents, knocking on doors. What were some of the issues they were most concerned about for the upcoming legislative session?
You know, it really depends. There are a lot of bigger issues that have been lingering at the state level and haven't really been well addressed. And I think that they remain the same issues that people are concerned with. Clean water, clean air. I think also improving the state's Medicaid and mental health systems. Those are all big issues and ones that we heard a lot about while knocking doors this last year. And people, I think, also, if you're close to education, whether you have a kid in the school system or you are yourself an educator, most school boards and community school districts are very well aware of how starved their budget has been. We're going on 4 or 5 years of historically low funding for public schools, and it's forced a lot of stress on local school boards and hard decisions. You know, here in Sioux City, we have many teachers who saw their pay cut by almost $5,000 a year. And if you're talking about several hundred individuals in a community that have now had their pay cut from the previous year, there's an economic impact and there's also an impact on morale. And so, you know, the core of state services, healthcare, education, public safety, they have all suffered over the last few years as our budget has seesawed back and forth. And my hope is that those who are in the majority and those who have control of government right now take a serious look at that and expect more of what they're putting together in the state budget. We can't just continue to cut taxes with a question mark on whether it's affordable. You know, last month we actually had another revenue estimating meeting, and it said that because of last year's state-level tax cuts, there is going to be $260 million less available for public services this coming year. $260 million is a huge amount of money to be taking out of the system when all of that $260 million is slanted toward a very small share of Iowans who will receive the tax benefit. It's just a question of priorities and where you're filtering those dollars. Should they be going to public schools or should they be going to the top 1% of income earners? Polling in the past has shown a strong majority of Iowans believe they should go to things like healthcare and education.
In past years, we've talked about the need to put more money to fund the judicial system in our state, in the counties. Seems like there's never quite enough money to make the system work and to deal with the backlog. So do you think that the legislature might be talking about that again this year?
Yeah, there was a moment last year during the budget debates where Senate Republicans initially proposed a very deep mid-year cut to the judicial branch. And the judicial branch came back respectfully and said, if you force this budget cut upon us, we will have to close likely 30 courthouses across the state. That's a big number of courthouses to go to part-time hours, or some of them closed entirely to have, you know, basic things like paying your property taxes or taking care of a bill. You have to go to the neighboring county to do it now. So the state has just not been responsible in how it's really been approaching the budgeting process or how it's treating the third branch of government, the judicial branch. If backlogs are the norm, and if we're not seeing any true investment in just even bringing staff levels up to where they were years back, you know, 10 years ago, they might have been better than they are right now. If we're not going to approach that conversation, people are also going to start to see it in daily service and a reduction of what they can expect.
That was Sioux City State Representative Chris Hall talking about their recent privatized Medicaid audit and also talking about some of the issues that are coming up in the legislative session that starts in January. Finally, a note that this week, Iowa's only medical marijuana manufacturer, MedFarm Iowa, saw a successful first weekend as its two dispensaries opened, one of them here in Sioux City, and its products went on sale across the state. Between Saturday and Sunday, MedFarm served about 15 patients in Sioux City and about 120 additional patients in suburban Des Moines. MedFarm representatives say the company still has more work to do educating doctors about how the state's medical cannabinoid system program works. It would also like to see more approved medical conditions on the program's list. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. I'm Mary Hartnett.